Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we
yes,
found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That was the great Dar Williams singing the Solartopia song with the immortal Pete Seeger, now 92 years old, and David Burns and the Rivertown Kids. That song is on the Tomorrow's Children album, which has won a Grammy. So we are a Grammy-winning operation here. I'm Harvey Wasserman with the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Hour for another discussion from True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California. We have with us the wonderful Dr. Allen, Dr. Allen and Dr. Nathan. Dr. Allen Goldhammer, Dr. Nathan Gershfeld. Last week we talked about great food, vegan diet, and we'll do that again today. We're going to talk first half hour, we're going to talk about the politics of a vegan diet and how it affects the earth, and then we're going to talk about fasting, which I have just completed. Well, I did it a week ago, 16 days on water. Nothing but water, distilled water here at the beautiful clinic in Santa Rosa. I lost 25 pounds. It was actually not my intent to lose weight, but I did. I got down to a weight that I haven't been since high school, and feel really, really healthy. I've been refeeding for the last week under the supervision of Dr. Goldhammer, Dr. Gershfeld, and others here at the clinic, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Before we get to that, though, I do want to cover some breaking nuclear news. We had a very big piece of news today that you will not be seeing much coverage of in the general media, which is the fact that Progress Energy in Florida has announced that they are postponing their proposed Levy County reactors, and that the price tag for 3 years, and the price tag has jumped to somewhere between $9.5 and $12 billion per reactor. And as far as I'm concerned, this is a gravestone on the nuclear power industry. There is no way that any company is going to be building a nuclear power plant where they're going to start construction 3 years from now, and where the projected price now is $9.5 to $12 billion a piece. It is just not going to happen, folks. And I believe we do have a petition at nukefree.org. The website I edit is www.nukefree.org, and I've posted that announcement there. There is a petition you can click on the sign that opposes loan guarantees for the proposed Vogtle reactor, V-O-G-T-L-E, in Georgia, which is slightly under construction, but we think we can stop it. And if you go to nukefree.org and find that petition, it's the second one down, we want to stop those loan guarantees. We think you can do it. And I think we are very, very close. I've been doing this since 1973. I think we're very, very close to making it a reality that there will never be any new nuclear plants built in the United States. That is a big, big deal, and I am happy to say that the announcement by Progress Energy today that there's a three-year delay in the Levy County reactors. That means that, as far as I'm concerned, they are not going to be built. And the price tag, which they've admitted to, $9.5 to $12 billion per reactor, is completely prohibitive, totally out of the ballpark, not even close to being able to compete with solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, all the solartopian forms of energy that we talk about on this radio show. So that's the good news today, and then we have more good news. The more good news is we have Alan Goldhammer and Nathan Gershfeld with us. I am here at the Santa Rosa Clinic, the clinic in Santa Rosa, the True North Health Center, and had an amazing time. Dr. Allen, One of the things you talked about, one of the things they do here at True North is there are daily talks by the doctors. I've heard many from both Dr. Grossfeld and Dr. Goldhammer. And one of the things you discussed, Dr. Goldhammer, in your most recent talk is something that's of great interest to all our listeners, which is the environmental impacts of meat consumption and production. And can you give us, and talk as long as you want, really, go into detail as you would, and Nathan, Dr. Grossfeld, you can jump in whenever you like, about the environmental impacts of raising and eating meat.
Well, you know, meat's a very expensive commodity in terms of the cost directly to production as well as the impact of that production on the environment. The fact that animal products sell at the prices they do is in large part because there's tremendous direct and indirect subsidies to this industry. A significant percentage of water, for example, is used in supporting this industry, and the cost of that water is subsidized through various intervention. The cost of raising the animals themselves, oftentimes with feed and supplies that may be subsidized, and then the production and distribution of these products also is an expensive and impacting process. I don't think there's a lot of controversy. The fact that, you know, there's a much more to the cost of animal products, both in terms of than the cost of raising it, in terms of environmental impact, and also to the health of individuals and the subsidies that we all end up paying to support people that are suffering from cardiovascular disease and cancer and the like as a consequence of our animal-based dietary habits.
Well, tell us a bit about the industrial production of meat, how it's done, if you would, and how it impacts the environment.
Well, I mean, obviously today the images that people have of, you know, free-range cattle grazing on some grass, low intensity, is in stark contrast to the reality where industrial feedlot production has turned the raising of animals into an automated process that bears little resemblance or concern for the fact that you're dealing with sentient creatures that are raised in what many would consider inhumane and unsanitary circumstances and subject to efficient but less than optimum processing procedures, which compromises not only the quality of the animal's life but the quality and the quantity of the people who choose to kill it and eat it.
Dr. Grossfeld, have you ever been to a feedlot?
I have as a kid.
Tell us about it.
Well, I don't remember very much about it, but what I wanted to say was a lot of our diseases, whether they're caused a little bit from animal consumption, but most of the time it's eating unhealthy foods, things like salt, sugar, oil. And what's happening is a lot of people are getting overweight and obese to the point where now the Federal Transit Administration wants buses to be tested for the impact of the heavier riders on the steering and the brakes. As a result of that, we know that cars are now burning about 1 billion gallons more of gasoline per year, more than when passengers weighed. They're burning more than about 1 billion gallons a year more per year than when they did in 1960. And the reason is because people are weighing on average about 24 pounds heavier, and so that.
Wait. Who weighs 24 pounds heavier? The American public is on average 24 pounds overweight?
The average American weighs 24 pounds more than they did in 1960.
Jeez.
As a result,
everybody's a foot taller, right?
As a result of that, the cars are burning about 1 billion gallons of gasoline more. And so because of that, we're spending a lot of money on healthiness, a lot of money on obesity, and not just the government, people too. If you own a business, people who are the most obese take 5.9 more sick days per year than the average person. The obese women take about 9.4 days more per year than a non-obese person. This costs about $6.4 billion a year for employers in lost productivity and in lost working time.
Well, let's back up just a minute. You said something about, are you saying that there's a calculated cost for automobile gas mileage relating to schlepping around people who are weighing 25 pounds more than the other one?
So I'll give you an example. What everybody knows if you drive your car and you load it up full of weight, it's going to take a little bit more gas because you need a little bit more gas to take the car because it weighs a little bit more.
Uh-huh.
Same thing happens. You're carrying the weight, whether it's fat or luggage or little or small children. So all of these things have a great impact on our productivity, on our bottom line, to the point where all these lost days can be calculated. Even things like being present at work but having decreased productivity, it costs the average employer to have an obese worker $3,792 per year.
Oh, my God.
So it's not to say that people shouldn't be hiring obese workers. It depends on the worker. A lot of workers are very good and very productive. But the cost of all this sickness is taking. And even this can be estimated about $30 billion per
uh-huh.
year just from people being obese for productivity.
Of course, on the other side, we can be proud that Americans have reached number one status in the world for the percentage of our population that has achieved obesity. And given the significant increase in strategic fat reserves that we're storing on the waists and hips of Americans, we can be confident that if spring comes late, we'll survive.
Yes. Well, it depends on how late. That's interesting. Well, let's back up, though. Let's talk about that a little bit. I want to back up, though, and let's talk about the actual physical production of meat. In 1970, I was living on a hippie farm in Massachusetts, and we had animals, and we were eating meat, and I participated in the slaughter of a cow and two pigs. And then the next cow came, and me and this cow were pretty tight. And I just said, you know, I'm not going to shoot this guy. And his nickname was Hamburger. And everybody said, well, you know, if you're not going to participate in killing the cow, you shouldn't eat the meat. And I said, well, I won't. And so that's when I became a vegetarian of sorts. I also stopped eating chicken because then they went chopped their heads off. But I continued to eat fish and dairy. And then in the 1980s, I read a book by your cohort, Dr. John McDougall, who I hope to have on the show one day. And I had met him actually in Hawaii. And he, the McDougall Plan, a really big selling book over the years. Doctors, you may know how many copies it sold, the McDougall Plan, but it must be hundreds of thousands.
Sure.
He convinced me that
very popular book.
Yeah, very popular and very influential. I mean, it was the first book, real vegan book I read. And he argued very strongly against eating dairy. And convinced me to give it up, even though I was milking cows at the time. Well, actually, especially because I'm milking cows. I don't know how many of you listeners have ever milked a cow, or doctors, if you ever milked a cow, but it's kind of fun, but, you know, really kind of disgusting to drink the milk after you do that. So I stopped drinking milk, but I continued eating fish until Fukushima. And Fukushima more or less has convinced me to not eat fish, although coming here, of course, we'll talk about this in the second hour. You have a vegan plan. But when I stopped eating meat for the first time, I read an amazing book, a very, very powerful and influential book. Now I think in its 20th or 21st edition, called Diet for a Small Planet by Frances Moore LePay. And in this book, she argued that, as you did, Dr. Goldhammer, about the water, not only the water consumption of industrial meat production, but also the grain, the amount of grains that are used. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, you know, meat is a relatively inefficient process for generating calories because it takes multiple pounds of grain, for example, to produce a pound of meat. So when you actually figure out what's happening is you're taking a lot of energy, usually from oil, and combining it with photosynthesis to generate plant material, and then taking multiple pounds of plant material in order to generate a pound of meat. So you're taking things through many steps, and there's an inherent inefficiency in that. What's much more efficient is to rely predominantly on photosynthesis to produce the energy and eat the grains directly or the starchy vegetables directly. You know, you had mentioned Dr. McDougall as writing the McDougall Plan, which is a really revolutionary book at the time. I happen to know that on May 8th, he has a new book that's coming out, and he once again has really done some groundbreaking work. It's called The Starch Solution by John McDougall, M.D. And in it, he really, I think, addresses this social issue that we've all been exposed to in terms of promoting a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet as some kind of health panacea through, most recently, Dr. Atkins and other types of books. Well, this book rather compellingly and convincingly puts to rest all of the mistakes and misconceptions that have been promulgated in the interest of promoting junk food. And in The Starch Solution, John McDougall does an excellent job of telling the truth in a way that's completely understandable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm excited. I'm hoping it'll shift the public discussion back towards eating a starch-based diet rather than a meat-based diet, because it'll certainly help the people, the individuals that eat it, and I think it would probably do more for helping our environment and the planet than any other single behavior change that humans could adopt. Not
to mention our intelligence.
Oh, you think we'll be smarter if we have a vegan diet?
They have now started to quantify that dietary patterns in childhood is associated with IQ. So
really?
When you eat healthier, your children are smarter, and they have a higher intelligent quotient.
Well,
and this means that when they had the processed high-fat, high-sugar food, they had it was negatively associated with IQ. And it starts as early as 8 years old, and between 3 years old and 8 years old. So we're introducing these foods to our children, and they're getting smarter. They're getting dumber. They're getting more overweight. And it's no wonder why now the New England Journal of Medicine is expecting that this is the first generation of children that will die before their parents, that has lower life expectancy the first time.
Okay. Well, that's a really important, interesting stuff. We're on the Soratopia Green Power and Wellness Show with Dr. Alan Goldhammer, director and founder of the is that correct? You are the founder. I'm not sure officially you're the director of the True North Health Clinic and here in Santa Rosa, California, where I am, and Dr. Nathan Gershfeld on staff here. I've completed a 16-day fast and now a week of refeeding. Thankfully, I put on 6 or 7 of the 25 pounds I lost. Hoping to put on a bit more, I'm sure I will. We want to go back real quickly to the industrial implications or impacts of meat raising. I have been actually on a feedlot in Colorado. It was owned by my cousin, and I turned up there, and of course they had to show me around and all this stuff, and then they took me out to dinner. I had to explain to them I was a vegetarian. But that was an amusing moment. But, I saw literally 10,000 cows standing knee-deep in their manure, unable to move, being grain being crammed into their faces. And if you drive through the Midwest, Minnesota, the Dakotas, Kansas, Nebraska, it's all corn and soy, and it's all basically to feed cows. And Diet for a Small Planet, the original sort of Bible of the environmental impacts of meat production, industrial meat production, pointed out that well over 80% of all the grain raised in the United States goes to fattened beef cow. In other words, our number one agricultural product after marijuana in this country is cholesterol. And would you agree with that, doctors? Hello?
Yes. I'm not sure on the specific numbers, but clearly this is a major money-making enterprise. When you look at the billions of dollars that are generated by people like the meat and dairy industry, you can understand how they've been able to develop such tremendous influence, including instituting supposed educational programs in our school systems that are really nothing more than marketing campaigns.
Right. And, it's a disaster. And what the additional environmental impacts, of course, are that the Amazon rainforest is being chopped down, with huge implications for global warming and other environmental impacts, basically to raise crops or to graze beef cattle. And we're going to touch a little more as we go on the health implications, health impacts of meat production. But I will say, Dr. Goldhammer, you mentioned at the beginning the use of water. According to raise industrial meat, according to Diet for Small Planet, it takes 16, that's 1/6 pounds of vegetable protein to produce 1 pound of meat protein. Have you seen that number anywhere?
I've seen various numbers depending on the source you look at, but clearly it's a much more cost effective and environmentally effective to provide people calories from plant-based foods than it is to process those plant-based foods through animals, with the inherent inefficiencies to produce animal-based products with all their health consequences. I don't think that's really too debatable.
Right. And I guess the good news is that if we stopped eating meat, if we went to a vegetarian or vegan diet and cut out industrial meat production, and that includes, by the way, it's not just cattle, it's pigs, and we have these huge pig farms, and they're not farms, I mean, they're factories, and chickens and eggs, I mean, and dairy. So we have basically five animal fat products, cow's meat, pork, chickens, chicken meat, chicken eggs, and dairy, which are done in an industrial mode, which consume huge quantities of water. 80 to 90% or more, by some calculations, of the grain production in this country. And then we're chopping down rainforests all over the country, all over the world, to grow still more, to feed a meat habit that is destructive of our health. Is that a reasonable summary of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you look at one of the charts that I saw in Dr. McDougall's new book, is he compared the total global emissions by sector, and he compared transportation to livestock. And
uh-huh.
So if you look at transportation, the entire transportation industry, 14% of global emissions is generated by transportation industry, 18% by livestock.
Wow.
If you stopped eating meat, you could have a bigger impact on global warming than if you stopped every automobile on the planet from driving.
Say that again?
If you stopped people from eating meat and they chose to eat plant-based foods instead, you'd have a bigger impact on global warming than if you managed to convince everybody to turn off their engines.
Wow. Actually, yes. I saw a movie here at True North called The Rave Diet. And in The Rave Diet, it was very interesting. They actually took a strong issue with Al Gore. You know, Gore, of course, is famous for raising the issue of global warming and the movie Inconvenient Truth, which I liked the middle part, but I hated the beginning and I hated the end, and I'll tell you another time why. But he says that cow production actually causes more global warming than industrial energy production. Because all the grains that are wasted, B, all the water, and C, all the methane gas that comes out the rear end of the cattle.
Livestock generate both nitrous oxide, methane, and ammonia. And nitrous oxide has 296 times the global warming potential, and methane has 23 times the potential of CO2.
So you
realize it's not just how many grams of a particular substance are produced, but the impact that it has on global warming. And, of course, you know, with ammonia, you get the acid rain issue and the ecosystem acidification. And, you know, essentially, livestock raising all over the world right now is responsible for devastating effects, particularly when livestock is raised on lands that without the trees and support tends to degrade and fall apart, and then you get a desertification type effect.
Devastating. We're on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're with Dr. Alan and Dr. Nathan, and we're having a really big discussion here on global warming, Dr. Al Goldhammer, Dr. Nathan Gershfeld on the ecological impacts of the production of meat. It is a huge global industry, and of course it's rising. Now, one of the things that you are, Dr. Goldhammer, closely associated with I'm associated with the China syndrome. You're associated with the China study. Can you talk about Colin Campbell's work and what that says about the general societal impacts of meat consumption?
Well, Dr. Campbell has published a book called The China Study, which is a book that summarizes some of the 350 papers that he's published in the scientific literature and details his work looking at the impact that diet has on particular disease. And I think he's fairly compellingly and convincingly argued that with animal products, particularly dairy products and animal proteins, you can literally turn on and off these cancer gene markers and the associated risk of developing cancer in humans. So he feels that and I think argues convincingly that an animal-based diet is extremely detrimental to health, and in particular the relation to diseases such as cancer and heart disease, you know, intimately associated with it. I think that the more you look at the data, the more convincing it is that minimizing or eliminating animal food is probably, if nothing else, in our individual health interest, and clearly it's in the interest of the planet. Do you know, you were talking about Amazon rainforest. I have data here that suggests that over 70% of the Amazon rainforests have now been given over to grazing.
Oh, my God.
And when you think about those rainforests as kind of the lungs of the earth, you realize that, you know, that can have very serious and long-term consequences, not only on the people that are living in the area, but on the entire planet.
Yes, and there is a very well-known cycle that occurs. I'm sure you're familiar with it, Dr. Goldhammer and Dr. Grossfeld. When you cut down the rainforest, you know, the soil in the rainforest is very shallow.
Yes.
The vast amount of nutrients are stored in the canopy and in the trees that rise above it. And so when you cut down the trees and then you plant grass and then you bring in cattle or you just raise, you know, soy and whatever else they raise for feed, sooner or later there's a dry year. Because when you cut down, the canopy is dark green. And so it cools the air above it and it attracts clouds. And when you cut down that, and even if you plant regular grasses, the color is brighter. And then inevitably, there's a bad year or two and things turn brown. And then the sun bakes it, and the canopy doesn't come back, the grass doesn't come back, and you wind up with desert. And what you've done in a very short period of time, use a maximum of 10 to 15 years, is convert rainforest into desert. And that's what's happening all over the world to feed our meat addiction. And I've been here kicking that addiction, at least to fish as well as to meat, as well as to salt, oil, and sugar at the True North Health Center in Santa Rosa, California. We're talking with Dr. Goldhammer, the director of the center, and Dr. Gershfeld, a practitioner here. I'm Harvey Wasserman. This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. And the second half hour, we're going to talk about fasting and why we don't do salt, oil, and sugar. But before we go away from this environmental impact, what do you think of the general politics of meat? Oh, let's take the break. We'll come back to that, the politics of meat, after our break here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
In air, water, rooftop gardens,
back with Dr. Alan Goldhammer and Dr. Nathan Gershfeld here at the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California for the second half hour, the second of our two shows on veganism, diet, fasting, the impacts of the ecological and political impacts of meat. And we are now in the nitty-gritty time. We're going to talk about fasting and the health benefits of fasting and of veganism. Dr. Goldhammer, you are a pioneer in the and a great one at that, in the use of fasting as a health tell us what it is. Tell us about fasting. Tell us what the impacts are.
Fasting is actually a very ancient practice. Moses, David, Elijah, Jesus, if you read the Bible, were said to have fasted for as long as 40 days. There's probably no religious or spiritual factors on the planet that I've heard of that don't have some type of tradition about fasting associated with them. So this is actually a very, very ancient practice. And you know, what we've been doing for the last 30 years is applying this ancient practice, taking advantage of modern measuring techniques and clinical practices for a means of improving health, and a means of improving health quite rapidly. It turns out that a lot of people that are sick get sick because of dietary excess or exposure to various exogenous or endogenous toxins. So people accumulate these materials inside their cells, inside their bodies. It interferes with function, and ultimately people develop characteristic diseases, whether it be high blood pressure or diabetes or autoimmune diseases like lupus and colitis and asthma and related conditions. It turns out that these conditions that have as a common base dietary excess respond exceptionally well in many cases to a period of therapeutic fasting, which is a complete abstinence from all substances except pure water in an environment of complete rest. So when you put that constellation of factors together, you get an individual having absolutely nothing but water, and you have them resting in a supportive environment, the body does something really quite remarkable, and that's that it heals itself. Now, it does it in sometimes a rather intense way. While people are fasting, they go through all kinds of detoxification symptoms, which can sometimes be intense and even unpleasant. But the net result is that the overall total body load of these various substances, both exogenous toxins, things like PCBs and dioxins and mercury and heavy metals and other types of contaminants, as well as endogenous materials like excess cholesterol and uric acid and intracellular pigments, etc., are reduced. And when you reduce these various intermediary products of metabolism and byproducts and toxic products, the overall health of the individual improves, and it can improve quite dramatically.
Just from not eating?
Just from not eating in an environment of rest.
And drinking distilled water?
Yeah, we use, well, purified water, whether it's distilled water or other types of purified water, giving a person a supportive environment. The body does what it does best, and that's heal itself.
Dr. Gershfeld, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, fasting has been used for such a long time, but the thing is it hasn't been published very often. But the very first time it was ever published in a medical journal was in 1880, when a man by the name of Dr. Tanner actually performed his first fast. And the reason he started his fast was because he felt so sick and miserable from a lot of his health conditions that he decided that, hey, I'm not going to eat anything, and he decided to not eat anything so that he can die. Now, at that time, the longest time that people were considered to be able to survive without any food was about 10 days. So he decided, well, in about 10 days, he'll be finished with life, and he doesn't have to deal with all these things. Well, it turns out what happened was he fasted.
Did he drink water while he fasted?
He drank water while he fasted, and his colleagues, which were also medical doctors from the Neurological Society of New York, they decided to observe him and see what happened. And he lost about an average of 2 pounds a day in the beginning, but he ended up fasting for about 36 days total, and he got well.
Much to his chagrin.
Much to his chagrin. Well, it turns out that he was able to get rid of a lot of his conditions and enjoy life again. And so since then, it's been published in a lot of different capacities, not from just one journal or two, but it's been a therapy that's been used for a long, long time, and only recently has been being published in terms of objective data.
In 2001, Dr. Campbell, who we mentioned earlier, joined us in a study that we conducted. We observed 174 consecutive patients with high blood pressure. We decided to measure high blood pressure and the effect that fasting had on this condition. And of those 174 consecutive patients with high blood pressure, we were able to eliminate the medications and reduce the blood pressure to a level such that all 174 were able to eliminate the need for medication.
Every one of them.
And the average drop in stage 3 hypertensives, those people that started off with the higher levels of high blood pressure, where the systolic blood pressure started at 180 or above, dropped their blood pressure an average of 60 points. It turns out that's the largest effect that's ever been demonstrated in the scientific literature in treating high blood pressure patients.
And it's just from fasting. How long was the average fast?
It was about 10 days.
So if you go, if you have high blood pressure,
Dr. Goldhammer said it was 60 points. Now, just to give you an idea as to how much that is compared to all the other therapies, the therapies we're looking at are medications, maybe just exercise, weight loss, sodium restriction. Turns out if you use drugs for high blood pressure, you lose about 12. If you do a diet, you lose about 17 points. And if you lose weight, you get about 1.6 points for every pound that you lose, for every kilogram that you lose. So this is by far the biggest effect ever studied. And if you want to take a look at it, you can look at the website, healthpromoting.com, and it's detailed on that website. But more importantly, what it showed was that doing nothing, which in the sense is fasting, can actually help the body learn how to heal itself more so than any other therapy ever shown in the scientific literature.
What's more important, and I think impressive, is that of the patients, if you comply with a plant-based SOS-free diet, you're able to sustain the results that you generate, and we were able to demonstrate that. So, just like obesity, if people go back to a greasy, slimy, dead, decaying flesh diet that's high in salt, fat, and sugar, eventually they'd get their problems back. I'm sure the same thing would be true of people that fast for hypertension or any other condition. But for people that are willing to make radical diet and lifestyle changes and adopt a health-promoting diet, they can sustain these results, whether we're treating high blood pressure or patients with diabetes or patients with autoimmune disorders. So the good news is that it's not as helpless and hopeless as sometimes people are led to believe, that there actually is something that you can do, but it doesn't require people to be willing to accept responsibility for their health and their life and adopt, you know, some common sense practices, including adopting a plant-based SOS-free or sugar, oil, and salt-free diet.
We're talking with Dr. Alan Goldhammer and Dr. Nathan Gershfeld here at the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California, and you are telling us that if you have a high blood pressure, the best thing to do is to switch to a vegan diet and to fast. Is that correct?
What I'm saying is that absolutely adopting a health-promoting diet and lifestyle, which includes sleep and exercise, is the best approach to take. And if the results are not quick enough, medically supervised fasting is a way of allowing those changes to happen very rapidly.
What we're trying to advocate, Harvey, what we're trying to advocate here is that people have a lot more control over their health than they are at first led to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so resorting first to medications that can have many side effects and many, many other effects, not the least of which is getting people to have no hope in their own care. But what we're trying to do is to educate people that they can manage their condition by being largely dependent on themselves. Now, we don't have cures here. I don't want anybody to get a misunderstanding that we cure high blood pressure or that there's a cure for diabetes. What we do here is allow people to promote their own health where it's a management strategy. Like Dr. Goldhammer said, if they get their blood pressure back down, but then they go back and do whatever it was that caused the blood pressure, like eating salty food, like eating the dead, decaying flesh, and eating the unhealthy processed foods, they will go back to being sick.
The illusion with the use of medications in a condition like high blood pressure is, although you can reduce the blood pressure numbers slightly with the medications, you don't reduce the all-cause mortality concomitantly. It's a very different lowering blood pressure with diet and lifestyle in terms of its all-cause mortality reduction than it is lowering blood pressure with drugs. Because as the drugs may have some benefit for people with the highest levels of hypertension at reducing their stroke, it also introduces risk factors, not the least of which is the chronic cough, the fatigue, the impotence, and the sudden death that are associated with these medications. So although, yes, there is some benefit at the higher levels of hypertension, the overall benefit isn't nearly as great as people are led to believe. And so that ultimately the real answer to dealing with high blood pressure is to actually eliminate the cause of the hypertension, which is diet and lifestyle based.
Okay, so are you saying then that you've had people come here who have, with high blood pressure and with other symptoms of disorder, and that they have been helped?
What I'm saying is that, again, looking at the data, the vast majority of people that have high blood pressure can normalize their blood pressure enough to eliminate any pretense that there's a need for medication.
Uh-huh.
And even those individuals that may have some secondary hypertension issues or whatever that may not be completely able to normalize their function, can get dramatic improvement and increase the likelihood of them getting a normal lifespan by adopting health-promoting habits. And it's dramatically more effective than relying on medications alone.
What we're trying to get away from is giving up. We're trying to get people to give up the magic that if they take a pill or if they do some sort of quick therapy, that they won't have to do a lot of the hard work that's associated with changing their lifestyle. Now, a lot of people want to believe they can eat whatever they want and not gain weight, that they can eat whatever they want and not exercise and have good numbers, low cholesterol, low blood pressure, and a healthy lifestyle. But it turns out that they can't really do that. Our main message here at the True North Health Center is that health results from healthful living and nothing else.
And this illusion that people can do what they want and get away with it is a trap. In fact, we call it the pleasure trap, because it involves stimulating the pleasure sensing mechanisms of the brain with these various chemicals and drugs. And as a consequence, we wrote a book called The Pleasure Trap, which we believe is actually the hidden force that undermines health and happiness. So if people want to be healthy and increase their likelihood of being happy, what they can do is adopt these principles that we outline in The Pleasure Trap.
And so what we also do here is we provide people resources who actually want to get healthy, because it turns out there's a lot of misinformation out there in terms of how to get healthy. If you want to go to a physician...
Well, characterize that misinformation. Tell us, what are people told that will make them healthy that you believe is wrong?
Well, the most common thing that is told is, well, just try to eat healthier, and that's it. There's no guidelines. There's a lot of understanding about nutrition. It's, oh, well, eat a little bit more this, eat a little less that.
You know, one big misnomer is this idea of moderation, that people believe that if you just eat everything, but you eat it in moderation, you'll be healthy. It's almost a truism. Yet in reality, we know that that's not true. For example, with alcoholism, we don't teach our alcoholic patients, well, you're a drunk, you need to learn to drink normally. So just drink less, or just drink beer and wine, or just drink during certain times. We don't tell people that because we know it's nonsense. That the only way an alcoholic can make their life work properly ultimately is to decide each and every day to not drink. And just as people can be addicted to the artificial stimulation of dopamine in their brain from alcohol, people are also addicted to the artificial stimulation of dopamine in their brain from oil, salt, and sugar, these chemicals that we manufacture and add to our foodstuffs. And so ultimately we have to stop lying to people and telling them, well, if you're overweight, you just need to learn to eat less, because we know that doesn't work. There's a 97% failure rate on any established medical protocol in terms of dealing with obesity. Virtually everybody fails. And the reason is we're telling people to manage their weight much like we would be telling alcoholics to manage alcoholism by drinking less. What we have to do is tell people the truth. If you're overweight, it means you're fooling your brain's satiation mechanisms with certain chemicals added to your food.
What
if you want to lose weight
be?
And keep it off, you need to stop eating those chemicals.
Well,
and those chemicals
tend to be
SOS, sugar, oil, and salt.
Sugar, oil, and salt. And what other chemicals are people eating in the standard, what we call it the standard American diet, right? The SAD, S-A-D diet.
Well, obviously animal foods and pleasure trap chemicals like sugar, oil, and salt are the primary culprits. What we suggest people do is adopt a plant-based SOS-free diet. That means they're eating fruits and vegetables, minimally processed grains, beans, and nuts and seeds. The foods that humans always ate through the majority of our history. And avoid the animal foods and the highly processed foods that are more have been introduced in the last couple hundred years since the Industrial Revolution.
We are talking with Dr. Alan Goldhammer and Dr. Nathan Gersfeld at the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California, where I have just completed a week ago a 16-day water fast and now 7 days of refeeding. It's a beautiful place. I'm sorry to be leaving, but we have a nice sunny Californian day here. And we're talking about the benefits of a vegan diet. And also the thing that was most shocking to me was the question of olive oil. I always thought, and of course there's a huge literature or belief out there that olive oil is good for you.
Well, because something is less bad for you than something else doesn't make it good for you. It just makes it less bad. And olive oil has some advantages over other oils in terms of its essential fatty acid ratio being dominated by omega-9s rather than omega-6s, etc. But anytime you take a food, rip it apart, take out one component, in this case the oil, which, by the way, has 4,000 calories per gram, you end up with a highly concentrated, artificially stimulating product that results ultimately in obesity and problems.
Wow. And just to let your listeners know, when we're talking about calories, which is what we're worried about if we're trying to lose weight, olive oil is 120 calories per tablespoon. And every other oil that we eat is 120 calories per tablespoon. It makes no difference what kind of oil we eat. So if you're trying to limit calories, 120 calories of olive oil or any other oil is something that's very, very concentrated. Just to give you a comparison between oil and fruits and vegetables, one tablespoon of oil represents the same amount of calories as 1 pound of vegetables. So you can guess which one it's easier to overeat on. And that's the oil. It's a lot easier to shove in that oil into your stomach if you're already full and overconsume calories to the point where you're gaining weight.
Yeah, you have almost 2.5 times as many calories per gram in oil, say, as even pure sugar. And so it's very, very easy to fool the brain. You get into big trouble. And that's why we recommend avoiding oils in the diet. You get oil naturally occurring inside your fruits and vegetables that meet your essential fatty acid needs. But we don't need to use these highly processed byproducts in order to be able to fool our brains into eating more of a substance that we should be avoiding consuming excessively.
I want to bring up, Goldemer was saying that it's fooling our brains. And I want your listeners to understand what we mean by fooling your brain is that your brain gets a chemical called dopamine that stimulates when there's more calories in your food. And that was an ancient mechanism that was adapted so that ancestors don't die if they misunderstand the calorie content of food. And so if you have foods that taste a little better, it's because they probably have more calories in them. Example, what tastes better, a potato or a potato chip? The reason is the potato chip tastes better is because it's got oil in there. And so it calorie concentrates the food by about 200 times. And so the reason why people enjoy that they enjoy is because they have more calories in them. And so it's not so much that, oh, you need these nutrients or you need your meat or you need your salt or you need your oil. It's that your brain knows which foods have more calories in them. And so this becomes destructive because when you try to change your diet, your brain is signaling to you that you are making a mistake. It's telling you that, oh, you shouldn't be consuming fewer calories because if spring comes late, you might die. And so this is called the pleasure trap, where you have pleasure derived from foods that are high calorie, but it's a trap because they're undermining your health at the same time. And so what we try to do is we try to teach people that how to do this and how to escape from this trap.
As you know, Harvey, a lot of people are a little reluctant and resistant at first, just like people are addicted to alcohol and coffee and other chemicals. When you ask people to make changes and give up their highly processed foods, the oil, sugar, and excess salt, at first, there's a natural resistance. And sometimes that resistance is so great that people just have trouble doing it on their own. And just like some alcoholics need a little bit of assistance to get free of their addiction to alcohol, some people need to have a little help to get free of their addiction to highly processed foods. And so what we do is we run a facility called the True North Health Center in Santa Rosa, California, where people can come and under direct medical supervision undergo a period of fasting. And during fasting, very rapidly, it acts very much like rebooting a computer. You know, you shut the computer off, you turn it on, a lot of the corruption that has been there clears itself away. And the same thing's true with fasting. Taste neuroadaptation occurs during fasting such that good foods then start to taste good. And afterwards, people are willing and able to consume a health-promoting diet that's plant-based and SOS-free, enjoy their food, and thus we're on the path to helping people make the diet and lifestyle changes they need to recover and sustain their recovered health.
Well, Dr. Goldhammer, in your talk, I think most people understand, it makes sense why oil and sugar would be bad for you. And I will reiterate for those who listen to the show regularly that I had a tumor diagnosed in my lung last June. It turns out to be not cancer. But when the diagnosis came, I stopped eating sugar, stopped drinking concentrated fruit juices, and lost 20 pounds, really without batting an eye. Salt is a mystery.
Salt is a precious and necessary commodity. It's an essential nutrient without which you would die. In fact, it's so precious and so rare in nature that our bodies are designed to detect it at a very small concentrations and to hold it and store it as the you know, essential nutrient that it is. And that worked fine for thousands of years, because the salt in naturally occurring in food helped our brains detect which foods we should eat and which we shouldn't. It allowed us to eat the nutrient-rich foods that were necessary for human survival, and we got all the sodium that we needed from our plant foods. But then recently, we discovered how to make salt, essentially dehydrate salt water and find concentrated salt sources. And even though early on it was a very precious commodity, it was actually used as money. It was a means of exchange. The term salary comes from the inherent value that salt contained. As we learned to process salt and make it available, of course, our brains still thought that, you know, salt is always a good thing. Get as much as you can, and most importantly, hold on to it. And about a third of the population is even more efficient than the rest at holding on to salt, and those that do and get exposed to too much of it develop high blood pressure. And one of the major contributing causes to high blood pressure is excess salt exposure, which causes the body to hold excess water to neutralize its effect, and as the blood volume goes up, so does the blood pressure. It's interesting that, you know, salt is a very effective emetic. If you give patients a tablespoon of salt, it'll cause them to vomit, and in somewhat higher concentrations, it'll actually kill people. So yes, you're designed to require and crave small amounts of salt, but you're not designed to process the large amounts that we get in our diets today. People need about a gram of salt or 1,000 milligrams of sodium a day. We're getting 5 to 20 times that much by eating at places that serve fast food and use salt to make up for the fact that their highly processed food products on their own don't taste very well at all.
And what does salt do to your arteries?
Well, what salt does to your arteries actually is the effect that happens. When salt creates high blood pressure creates a lot more problems and damage to your arteries, and that in turn creates atherosclerosis, which results in heart disease.
And doesn't the salt, I think I heard in one of your lectures, Dr. Goldhammer, that salt enters the cells and makes them rigid?
Well, excess sodium does all kinds of things, including even contributing to conditions like osteoporosis, for example, because of the interchange that happens between sodium and calcium, its effect on the kidney. So, you know, there's a whole host of biophysiological changes that occur in animals when they consume too much salt. The other thing to think about is sodium. Again, it's because it's playing off this, and if you continue to drink alcohol, you become dependent on sodium intake, and now you can't even taste foods. As your body neuroadapts to the higher sodium intake, you can't even eat whole natural foods because they're no longer addicted to the artificial stimulation that comes from consuming high concentrations of this processed food product.
We are we're nearing the end here. We've just got a couple more minutes, one or two actually. If you could, Dr. Alan Goldhammer here at the True North Health Clinic, can you sum up the benefits? We've talked about the environmental benefits. What if people go vegan, if they stop eating fish, meat, chicken, dairy, salt, oil, and sugar, what are the benefits?
Well, I can't guarantee that if they go vegan and eliminate SOS that they'll get into heaven, but I can promise you that you're likely to delay how soon you'll be going.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's been a wonderful 2 hours with you guys. I much appreciate it. Dr. Alan Goldhammer, founder and director of the True North Health Clinic in Santa Rosa, California. Dr. Nathan Gershfeld on the staff here. It's been enlightening. You have convinced me to go vegan, and I hope others will as well. Next week, we'll be back again with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman, and we'll see you in Solartopia.
Well, we bit the apple, and the garden was lost. And so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But don't you know it?